coach to many, many young people who are in their formative years. And from the time they begin to hear and believe that we can embrace and fellowship all these people, the unsaid message that comes across is that these issues don't matter anymore. And that's just exactly what they began to believe. And that's why congregations began disintegrating over time. Because really, doing things in the Lord's way and with mutual edification and all is a pretty difficult way to go. And if these issues don't make any difference anyway, then, well, I'm going to go over here. The best place that they went was to the real liberal churches of Christ. But a lot of them wound up in the Christian churches or the Baptist churches. I have relatives of my own, as many of you do, who wound up in just that way, based on this kind of a philosophy. It started out as one thing, and it quickly evolved into something else. Not that Carl ever meant for it to be that way. Almost all of these religious leaders could not see the end from the beginning, as the Bible says that God does. They could not call the things which be not as though they were. But the result of this, well, right here in Kansas City, the congregation over at 59th and Kenwood eventually completely ceased to exist based on attempting to live by this kind of a philosophy. There was no reason for us to exist anymore because there's no reason to be distinctive. Everybody just has their own opinions about things. And basically, one opinion becomes as good as another in the coin of the realm. That seems to be the way it comes out in practical application. And it wasn't just here in Kansas City. Many of you well know experiences that were had in other parts of the country. Out in the first congregation I ever went to, where I was carried in as a baby, was at 10th and Gary out in Pomona, California. And eventually, the Church of Christ sign was removed from that building and laid in the backyard until it kind of rotted away and eventually completely disappeared. Instead of that, it was the Pomona Christian Center with instrumental music and all sorts of other things. It no longer looked like a Church of Christ, and I'm not talking about the building. And the candlestick cannot remain under that sort of a situation. We could talk about Nixa and Denver and so on and so forth. But I don't think we need to multiply the cases here, and I certainly do not want to open old wounds. I hope I made that clear yesterday. My only reason for going into this at all is basically for the young people who, for the most part, have no idea about this and need to realize that it can happen again at any time and need to be, as much as possible, prepared before the bow is drawn against them. That's the reason for looking at it, and this is not intended in any other way. Most of those who accepted what Carl taught about fellowship just scattered everywhere. And I saw this happening all over the place when I was a boy. This is an emotional issue for me because I wasn't very old, but I could sure feel what was happening all around me. I saw the men gathered up in living room after living room and discussing these things with a great deal of emotion. And you'd have to be dead to not know that there was something amazing going on all around you. Many congregations were split. We need strong, godly elders who will watch for the souls as they that must give an account. Anything that puts danger in the way of our brethren is not safe for them. If it's something that's questionable, it's better just to leave it alone. Don't put it up on the bulletin board. Don't even seem to endorse it. Now, to a certain degree, of course, what people decide individually and on their own to do is up to them. Elders don't have complete control over people's lives. But we have to be sure, I believe, that as congregations or as the leadership of congregations, we don't put people in a position where we're seeming to endorse, say, youth rallies, for instance. Many people are around us in our communities who would just love to have our youth come to their rallies, and they're attacking us where we're the most vulnerable. The Lord's church is like a peaceful dove, but it's flying in the midst of hawks and vultures who will take her in if they can and pick her to pieces. And when they ask for your children to be taken to these youth rallies where they're going to hear about all sorts of things that don't come from the Bible and perhaps become fascinated by and interested in those things and form relationships with people who are interested in those things, that to me sets up red flags all over the place. We need elders, I believe, who can see the danger of this kind of possibility. We don't have any right to risk the souls of our brethren by exposing them to things, endorsing or seeming to endorse things that aren't right, and encouraging association with those that practice it. There may be a lot of reasons for it, but the danger to our youth, I believe, is one of the big reasons. It's better to drive an extra 1,000 miles and come to some place where the Bible is being taught, and hopefully the Bible alone, than to go across town to something that is questionable at best. So, and of course, this is preaching to the choir here, because you are the ones who have obviously done that to a great extent. Bill, please. Okay. 1 John 1 and 7. That certainly cannot be anything but appropriate in this context. It might be well for all of us to turn there, because we really should probably spend... This ends at 10:15. Okay, I still got 35 minutes. I was awful afraid it was about over. I'll ask Tychicus when I have pet nicknames for about everybody and don't usually share them. Once in a while they slip out. I call Richard Tychicus because it was Tychicus who delivered the Ephesian letter. And more than any other one man, Richard delivered the Ephesian letter to my generation. And nobody will ever be able to take that away from it. 1 John chapter 1, verse 7. If we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. And the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanseth us from all sin. We do need to try to be sure that we follow after that wisdom which is first pure and then peaceable. We want to be just as peaceable as we can. And I love the spirit that prevails among us right now. If history repeats itself, there will be times in the future where we don't have quite this same spirit among us. There probably will be times of unrest. But let's all enjoy the spirit of peace that we have while we can, and try to each individually do everything we can to keep that spirit of peace, also remembering that it's first pure and then peaceable. Bill, did you have something in particular you wanted to say about that? Right. Walking in the light. Right. 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 And to the extent that one of us is engaged in things that are at best questionable, then our association may need to be limited. Now, I don't think you have to either have complete relationship or maybe I'm not putting that very well, but complete association in everything or no association in everything. I do think circumstances alter cases here. Fellowship is like friendship in that way. There are varying degrees of friendship. That's obvious among you. And there are varying degrees of the association that we can have together based on a number of different factors. We need to be very, very careful with this idea. I think a part of what may have happened here is that sense of guilt that somebody was talking about the other day, and also the sense of reaction. And I like to think of our generation here as being kind of the third wave. If the first wave was Daniel Sommer, and that may not mean too much to a lot of you because we didn't even really get into that. But Daniel Sommer took a very hard-line oppositionary stance against the societies, which we also haven't talked about and I hope to get to in a few minutes, and against instrumental music and all of that. Very hard, definite oppositionary stance. We no longer will regard them as brethren. And then we come along with Brother Ketcherside in the next generation. Brother Ketcherside could remember Daniel Sommer sitting on his father's front porch and the older men talking about the church and related matters when Carl was a little boy laying there on his belly. So there's a natural line coming down there. And it's almost as if there was a guilt feeling, and it's a reaction against the past. I think Carl kind of went from one extreme to the other there with the swing of the pendulum, almost with that sense of guilt, that now we're just going to embrace everybody, and they almost outdid each other to see who could embrace the most people, to see who could be the most tolerant of virtually everything, and almost to the point of silliness sometimes, if it hadn't been so serious. Now I think we're at a time where none of us need have that sense of guilt at all, and I don't think we do, in just picking our associations. The church is kind of like a young girl of dating age. She doesn't have to go out with everybody who asks her, and she doesn't even have to tell them why. She can pick and choose those things as she deems best for whatever reasons, and the church is that way. If, for instance, your congregation simply chooses not to have association, at least in a formal way, with some other congregation, you don't have to explain why and feel guilty about that. It's simply a decision made at the congregational level. And I'm glad to see that I think we're at that place now. We've come away from what may have been extremes in a couple of generations, and I think we're more balanced now. Tom. Yes, he certainly did. Toward the end of his life, he made a complete switch in his thinking and began to be involved. Now, in his early life, he had been involved with institutionalism. He had actually attended Bethany College, arrived there 4 years after Alexander Campbell's death, and he said that the spirit of Alexander Campbell just pervaded the whole town. And it's a very interesting autobiography that Daniel Sommer wrote. But then he opposed the institutions, of course, all through the years until the very end. He lived to be 90 years old, and right when he was about, 88 or so, about 1938, he began to hobnob with those people again. Was strongly opposed by his son, D.A. Sommer. I mentioned D.A. Sommer yesterday, and somebody asked me who that was. That was one of Daniel Sommer's sons. I'm sorry I'm throwing all this at you piecemeal. I know it's not decipherable that way, but we didn't have time to really go through it. You wanted to say anything else about that, Tom? Thank you. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, they had quite a set to around 1947. He was talking about the relationship between Carl Ketcherside and D.A. Sommer. They had quite a set to around 1947 over a number of issues, and some congregations were split over that. But later on, after the fellowship explosion, that problem of the previous time almost kind of paled into insignificance there. D.A. Sommer was dead by the time the fellowship issue came to full bloom. I believe he died around 1953, if I'm not mistaken. So he wasn't around for that. Go ahead. Well, I mentioned, Tim asked about Leroy Garrett. I mentioned Leroy Garrett yesterday briefly. He wrote a book called The Campbell Stone Movement, and I cited for you something from that yesterday. Also, I think probably that reference I gave you last week about one person in 30 singing in the congregations at the time that instrumental music was starting to become an issue back in the last century. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that reference came from that book. I read that book when it originally came out, which was many years ago now, and I've kind of forgotten where things come from. But if I had to find that reference, I would start looking for it in that book. I think he's Roy Garrett first met Carl Ketcherside at the Paragould debate. Carl Ketcherside was debating G.K. Wallace on a number of these issues at Paragould, Arkansas, just across from the Boot Heel of Missouri down there in about 1951 or two, somewhere in there. And they happened to meet. Leroy Garrett was from the institutional churches as his background. Leroy Garrett is a kind of an interesting man. I think he decided relatively early in his life that he wanted to prove that that a high school dropout could graduate from, could get a PhD from Yale University. Is that right? He got one from either Harvard or Yale. I don't know. Okay, Harvard or Princeton or something. Anyway, he said he wanted to, I read one time where he said he wanted to prove that a high school dropout could get a PhD from One of those three institutions, I'm not sure which one it was. He probably went to them all. Anyway, he did that. The reason I'm bringing that up is that yesterday I mentioned that Carl always, at least to me, seemed to have a kind of an overblown deference to people who had higher education. And I said that I thought that that was partly because he didn't have it himself and just didn't realize what it actually is. That's one reason that I always advocate that young men who are interested in doing the work of an evangelist get themselves a bachelor's degree from some state college or something somewhere, in part so that they can see what it is and what it isn't. Also that this will help them to prepare themselves to earn their bread in some other kind of way, and they'll have more independence so that they can preach the gospel as it should be without having to worry about which side their bread's buttered on when the kids start coming along. So there are a number of reasons for that. But I think Carl might have been well served if he had just done a little more of that. I think he did go to a business college somewhere for a little while. But he always was bringing up and always felt like that his lack of education was an impediment. So he and Leroy both felt that way. Leroy, I think, overcompensated about being a high school dropout and went to those schools for years, and they had a profound impact on him. Anyway, these guys developed a relationship. They found that they had quite a camaraderie together. Their personalities were really quite different, but they fit together and liked each other real well and did work hand in glove together on many of these projects through the years. Tim, did you want to say something in particular about that?
No, maybe the relationship because they both published their own papers.
Yeah, they did both publish their own papers. Leroy Garrett's, it started out as Bible, this is interesting, it started out as Bible Talk back in the early 1950s. And then it switched to Restoration Review and was that for the rest of its time. Now you see the difference in emphasis there. First, we're talking about the Bible. That's where our focus is. And then, well, Leroy always had been interested in the Restoration Movement, but then we shift the focus away from Bible Talk, and we're going to talk now about the Restoration. We're so in love with that. I mean, the way he first starts out his publication is that Alexander Campbell was 35 years old when he started putting out a paper. I'm 35 years old, and now I'm starting to put out a paper. He's just in love with Alexander Campbell. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it went to the place where Campbell becomes more important than the Bible, or as important as the Bible. It's almost as if restoration history is on a par with what we read in Scripture. At least that's my interpretation of the events. It's certainly open to question from anyone. But, okay, go ahead. Yeah, eventually it was. And you can watch that change. If you take a full file of those papers and read the early ones, the focus shifts away. And we're more and more drifting into the mainstream of denominational thinking and wanting to be perhaps intellectually respectable. And that gets a lot of people. I really don't feel real comfortable singling these individuals out, but I don't know how else we can talk about history. And for most of you, Leroy Garrett's going to be more of a historical character, I think. He is still living down in Texas, born the same year that Winfred Lee and Bill Hensley were born, 1918. So he would be 82 years old at this time. Lowell, go ahead. Yeah, it's. I'm sure that I have commented on this to Brother Tom many times. I'm sure that editing a paper that goes out among us must not be a very enviable position. It's certainly not one that I would want. And I think that we can all thank Tom, to the extent that you take the paper and appreciate it at all, we can all thank Tom for the job that he's doing. The Mission Messenger probably began around 1960 under the editorship of Brother Roy Loney, and began as much as anything as a response to what Carl was teaching at that time. These two-week meetings began in 1960 as much as anything as a rallying point for the brethren who opposed what Carl was teaching at that time. So these streams of history are not far from it. But to get back to what Lowell has asked here, I think Tom is doing a wonderful job with the little paper that he puts out and sends out to us. But it must be very difficult with all the things that must be sent in and phoned in and computed in that people want put in that paper. It must be difficult to discriminate, and you probably hurt some feelings in deciding what to leave in and what to leave out. I'm not sure I would know how to go about it. But yeah, I know what you're talking about. It was at 6th and Izzard down in Arkansas. And the thing that had happened there was that the elders were not allowing the congregation to see the books, the financial records of the congregation. This is one thing we always need to be very careful about. And I think that's the point Leroy was making in that article, was that we need to be very careful. I don't know if it was or not, but it's the point that I would gather from that article and from the Bible. Paul said, referring to financial matters, when he was taking money from some people and giving it to some other people in another place, that we're taking pains here to make sure that everything is open and above board, not only in the sight of God, but also in the sight of man. Because people are funny about money, and when you're dealing with people's money, you need to have that wide open. The books of every congregation should be wide open to the members of that congregation so they can see where every penny went. And so to the extent that was his point, I have no problem with it. I do think it's easy for evangelists in general to stick their noses into situations where they have no business. If they have business with it, they'll be called into it. But I appreciate that point. I didn't get that impression from that particular article, but from some others I did. Thank you, Lowell. Lee, I think you were next.
Yes, I do. And I think I may have commented on that briefly yesterday, but we were going pretty fast.
He went to England in 1947 and again in 1951, and it had a profound effect on his thinking because he'd been here, born over in the area underneath St. Louis, and then lived in a lot of little places like up in Illinois and up north of Gallatin in the old Scotland Jameson area, and then in Chillicothe, and then over in Topeka. Just the country he came from was called the Midwest, and that was his beginning. And he became rather provincial, even though he was traveling all over the country, all over the United States. Really, the United States is one big place, and you don't get a global picture. That was especially true in the years before the war. And so now, right after the war, Carl goes over to England, and it did have a profound impact on him. I said yesterday that I thought maybe he was a little overawed by some of the brethren that he met there, but he found all kinds of ideas that he hadn't really thought about before in his little world here, where everything was pretty cut and dried, and we were in our own meeting houses, and we could handle the situation no matter who came in. But when he went over there, that's where he picked up closed communion, as you probably well know. And he brought it back here and tried to sell it with very, very little success. But I don't think he would have done that if he had. Yeah, I think it had an amazing impact on him because he always seemed to want to be cosmopolitan and be sure that his lack of education, I think there was an insecurity there. I shouldn't be even trying to. What happens here in these meetings is we just get so friendly with each other, we just sort of start, by the end, we're talking out loud to each other, and I forget that this is even a public meeting and going on tape. But I get the feeling like we're just sitting in our living room. I mean, my electrocardiogram is just way down low. So forgive me if I say something amiss or that ought not to be said. I knew it was risky when I started, but I felt the potential benefits outweighed that risk. Dwayne? Yeah. Yeah, well, he was a man that a lot of us knew. And I always liked Carl personally. I could certainly never follow him. In fact, I remember at the end of a three-hour conversation I had with him in 1977, I asked him, this was pertinent to some of the things we'd been talking about before, if I raise my children, I asked him, in an environment where they are
in constant religious association with those that I don't agree with. For instance, on the subject of instrumental music. If I raise my children when they're where they're constantly involved religiously with people who are practicing it, then aren't I giving them the wrong impression? Isn't that going to have an impact on them? Now, I may be able to keep my own convictions that I reached while I was not in fellowship with those people, but won't it be a problem for my children, and won't I have trouble with them there? And his only answer to that was, well, you're going to have trouble with your children no matter what. Now, to be fair about it, that came at the end of a three-hour conversation where we each had something else we needed to do, and so there wasn't really time to discuss it very much. But that was the only non-answer I got to that. I don't think there is a good answer to that question, and that is one of the fatal flaws in that position, is that relationships do affect how we think. Most of us are far too affected by the thinking of the people whom we're in constant contact with all the time. And we don't do, there are very few original thinkers among us. Very few thinkers, and that's not kind, but it's close. It's close, and I'm sorry, but it's close. You just have to deal with things as they are. And I think that was a practical flaw in there. So I want to put that in here, that I did not dislike the man. And I never knew him till he was an old man. But, well, actually, I guess I had been around him earlier. It was the strangest thing. That I had been around him when I was a boy and heard him speak. And then years and years and years went by, and I'd heard about every place I went, sitting in people's living rooms, the subject would come around to Carl. I guess that's why I call him that, because that's what everybody else called him. So I did look into it all because I wanted to see as firsthand as I could what it was that was going on. And I remember the first time that I heard his voice as a young adult, and I wasn't around him very much, but when I heard his voice as a young adult, it was like a wave of nostalgia because something in here triggered from when I had been at a double wedding that he performed for a couple of my distant cousins in 1959. It was a kind of a unique voice, a voice unlike anybody here today has. The closest thing among us today that I could compare it to would be the voice of Jim Basinger. You notice when the brethren imitate some of our colleagues, they'll imitate a number of different people, but who imitates Jim Basinger? How can you? You just don't have the physical equipment to do it. Maybe some people do, but I've never seen it really successfully done, because you may imitate the mannerisms, but you don't have the voice. And you know how Jim's voice carries. Carl's was like that. You couldn't help but hear him if you were in the vicinity of where he was speaking. So, what were you saying? I'm sorry, did I interrupt? What have I done? It's hopeless. Yeah, good. So I guess it doesn't matter what the question was. Janice, go ahead. Dwayne, if you want to follow up later, that's fine.
I read something that Paul wrote, probably in the 80s, I'd say, maybe the early to mid-80s, where he said before this fellowship issue came up, the church or people in the Church of Christ had the attitude, you know, kind of looked down their noses at people in the denominations or other groups related to it, thinking, I'm sure glad I'm saved, and I'm sure glad they're going to hell.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's not how I feel.
No.
And I wondered, I could see if he really thought that way, why did he think there would need to be a change in attitude? Right. I wondered, was that really representative?
I think it was representative. I do think that was representative. I'm seeing some head nods that are even grayer than my head, which is hard to be. But I think it was, and I think that was a part of what the reaction was against. It's hard to believe that you're right without developing a sense of spiritual pride about it. And that's the problem. The devil gets you either way. If you are practicing things that are not in the Bible and you're wrong, then he gets you. But then if you begin to assiduously study the Bible and you come to the place where you feel like you can apply that well, and now you're right, then it's easy to start feeling pretty good about yourself and looking down on everybody else. That's not the spirit that we should have. We should just feel humble that we have been allowed to have the truth and try to share it with people in a humble way. That's one thing I appreciate so much about the spirit of the brethren now, is that I do think that spirit prevails among us now, but I don't think it did. Well, I think that they were glad that they were going to hell if they didn't change. The idea was to try to get them to change, but we went about it in a very strange way.
See, I didn't get that idea from what you wrote. I got the idea that made us feel special because we were going to heaven and they were going to hell.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that.
Instead of a desire to save them.
I really do think there was a lot more of that than there is now. I think that a part of our better attitude probably came out of this fellowship issue. There are some good results of it, and I think that is one. I think there was one here. Were you going to comment, Richard, please? I don't see how you, I've never known you to do that.
There were two points that I think that you brought out that need to be addressed.
You want the mic? Will this one work? Speaking of that, thank you.
In every generation, we're going to have to teach ourselves and our children, go back to the Bible and know what the church is. Make sure that the church is according to the Bible. Everyone that's ever made an effort of any kind to improve their association with other groups by overlooking a principle have always developed a movement that led further and further from the Bible. When Brother Campbell established Bethany, his idea was education. Let's train people. Let's make sure they know what's right and they go out and teach what's right. But the principle behind that, the establishment of an institution to make sure that everything is right when the Lord had an institution. And that same thing came along. The idea of loving people and let's reach out and try to help people unfortunately led to a disregard completely of the principle of the New Testament. And brethren, I love dearly, have ended up in organization charismatic and everything else. And yet at one time they seemed to have been filled with the desire to follow the New Testament. Just one little step is almost irretrievable unless we always go back. What does the Bible say? What is the New Testament church? Because no one of any intellectual attainment and a charismatic personality or anything else will keep the church where it belongs if each and every individual does not go back to the Bible and make sure that we are what the Lord wants.
Very good. Why don't you just keep it? You might need it. Well, maybe I better put it here so it doesn't make noise, but we want all the comments from you we can get. Thank you, Richard. What is it? Is there something I should know? Oh, that's it. Okay. Marvin, go ahead.
I just wanted to express the traumatic feeling that you have when your brother you have you love like you love one another.
It was a tragic time, folks. I don't know of any way to describe it. I was a little boy, and it still gets to me when I think about it. Let me give you the mic, Mark.
I don't think we can imagine how tragic it is and traumatic it is when brethren who feel like we do toward one another have to part.
You going to say something? I don't know who was next. Michael, go ahead.
Could you comment, please, on the format of debating
its scriptural basis, if any, and its value, if any?
Well, there may be a place for it, but I agree with Carl's sentiment that it didn't seem like it changed very many people's minds. I'm not sure that the murder, malignancy, debate, deceit that we read about in the New Testament, I'm not sure the debate there is precisely the same thing as what we're talking about here. There is a place for a discussion, but we would hope that when we have a discussion that everybody is seeking for the truth. And I think it's easier to have that atmosphere if there aren't too many people there. Once you get an audience there, and then people come out and take a position, they feel almost duty-bound to defend that position, even when they're in a corner and they know that they're wrong. They often will find it hard to come out and say, well, I was wrong about that. Much easier in somebody's office or living room where there are just a few. So that's probably a better place for a lot of these discussions, I think, just on an informal basis. What it was, the spirit of those debates, as I understand it, and I was never at one of them, but Carl described it this way, and I get the sense from others that it was like you took a couple of roosters, or it was like a cockfight, where you take a couple of roosters, and each side has its own, and they're just seeing who can pick the other one to death. And you're bringing up a lot of stuff about personalities and all. Who weren't there, have read the books that came from those and seen the turmoil. So there was a high entertainment value there, and we're talking about the years when there was no television. High entertainment value, but as far as good, I don't know. I do think that it did help Carl to push the fight against institutionalism and for mutual edification into the South. The brethren down there were afraid of him, and he had a strong impact. I really think that probably the group today that has, it's the group that says everybody else's institution is wrong except ours, Florida College. And they probably would not have split off from that mainstream group had it not been for Carl's influence, because he brought some things to their thinking that they hadn't had before. So there probably was good done. I think it was limited, to briefly answer your question. Dave? Oh, I feel like that.
There's a major division in the church today about quote-unquote college churches and not.
Yeah.
And I feel that a lot of us don't know enough about that. Can you take 5 minutes?
Let's talk about that. The idea. The idea behind the institutions. In 1841, Bethany College opened its door to the first students. In 1849, the American Christian Missionary Society was formed. On your page on institutions, there is a phrase at the bottom there that talks about the principle behind them. And it's important to know what the principle behind them is. This was done by well-meaning brethren who did not stay with what the plan for the Lord's churches in the New Testament. They were established on that basis, that God has a certain work that he wants to get done, and the church isn't doing it. Therefore, we're justified in establishing this other institution to cause this work that God wants to get done to come to pass. Yes? Page 47. Thank you, Charles. It's very, very similar to the idea that Sarah had way back in the book of Genesis. God has promised Abraham a son, but it's not happening. It's some flaw in me. God can't do it through me. And so I'm going to give my Lord another bride, and she will do what I can't do in order to accomplish what the Lord wants done on this earth. Same principle here. We're not getting the evangelism done. That's the idea behind the missionary society. We're not getting the evangelism done the way it needs to be. The congregational autonomy is just too ineffective. It's too inefficient. And so we're going to establish this separate body in order to be more effective, more efficient in evangelism. And they did that with profound effect for the future. The ironic thing about it is that really the church spread faster before they had the society than it did afterward. If you date it from like 1809, when Alexander and Thomas Campbell got together and both found to their mutual relief that they both changed their mind and were out of Presbyterianism from 1809 to 1849 when the society was formed, 40 years. The church grew faster then than it did after they established the society. But the idea was that we need this, we're justified in forming it, because it will do what we aren't doing or we can't do. But the fact is that the Lord has made it possible for the church, as the church or as the individuals in the church, to do everything that he wants done religiously on this earth. And when we establish another institution, well, you've heard the baby tiger illustration. It's just like nursing a baby tiger. It starts out one way, and the ideals of the founders are high. But it doesn't stay as a baby tiger. It grows up, and pretty soon nobody can control it. There is an inevitability of development that has never been stopped in the history of this world. It always progresses that way. Bethany College became something that Alexander Campbell would have abhorred. And you can say that of virtually everybody who has ever started a school or had a school started in his name. This always comes about. There is no way you can control these institutions for any length of time and have them remain the same. So we could go on and on, but I've got 4 minutes left here. I just don't know what to do. I'd use the third chapter of the Ephesians letter on that. Ephesians chapter 3, verse 10. Who is it? To what institution did God give the right to teach about religious things? The church. Is there any other institution that God gave the right to teach about religious things? Not the home. I'm sorry. That kind of reminds me of a little story. I don't know. Do I have time to tell it or not? Everybody smiles at me but John. Maybe I'll just... I don't know. All right. I don't know even how pertinent it is, but it just reminded me of that, about the home. I do think we need to make this point. And this is a story from my family. I don't even like to use family illustrations. I used, I think, two of them yesterday and felt funny about that, but I'll use one. And I don't even know if this actually happened, but this was the way the story came down to me. It involved my father when he was just 4 or 5 years old, a little boy himself, when Uncle Earl came to visit. Do you know what I'm going to tell? You don't? Well, maybe you'll remember. I'm sure you've heard this. Uncle Earl was my grandfather's brother. He was a professor. He was the head of the philosophy department at South Dakota University. And he was an absolute atheist and was militant in the promotion of his views. And he came down to Kansas City and visited with my grandfather's family when my dad was a little boy. And one day, my grandpa was at work. Does any of this sound familiar yet? Okay, I'm getting a nod back there. Is there anything wrong about what I've said? The details are okay. And my grandpa was at work. My grandma walked in on Uncle Earl, and he was teaching my dad to be an atheist when my dad was just 4 or 5 years old. Well, she was about 85 pounds of woman, but she took big bad Uncle Earl and threw him out. I don't think they ever did talk again. For however many decades, I don't think they ever spoke again. But to me, that points up the fact that it cannot be that the family, extended or nuclear, has the right to teach on religious matters, because most of them are not even qualified to do so. When Paul says to the Ephesian brethren in the 6th chapter there, and he talks about the 4th verse, "Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." That's written in the context of the Ephesian church. Those were Christian fathers. And of course, if you're a Christian, you do have the right and the obligation to teach your children, but it's because you're Christians, because you're a part of the family of God, and not because of the home per se. So I do not believe that the home is given this authority by God. In answer to your question, I go a long way around in getting to the answers to these, but I'd use that third chapter of the Ephesian letter. Richard, do you want to comment on that any? We got 1 minute. Where'd that go? You want to?
You go ahead. You're doing a beautiful job.
Well, I don't know.
Qualified by itself.
I mean, it's qualified if the Christians in it are qualified. Yeah. The non-Christians in it are not qualified.
You sound like the home could not be
peaceful. No, that's why I quoted Ephesians 6 and 4. Fathers, Christian fathers, he's writing to the church. It's Christian fathers and mothers who are supposed to do this. God does not give to the home in general the obligation of doing that. It's to the church. It's by the church that these things are made known, not only to all men, but even to the angels. And as I said the other day, if the archangel Michael has to learn it through the church, why do we need someplace else to learn it? Well, we didn't even get to that page on fellowship and membership, and we didn't get to so many things, and I'm sorry. Richard, you want to talk a minute? Where did that mic go? Okay, please. We'll just end with you.
Thank you. The home as such.